We're going to resume. If people could take their seats. Please do go ahead and continue eating. Not that I could stop you, but we're going to begin the luncheon part of our program with our guest speaker, Andrew C. McCarthy. He is a senior fellow at the National Review Institute and a contributing editor of National Review. He's also, importantly, a New York Times best-selling author. That's not an easy thing to do. And his books are as good as his talks, and his talks are excellent. So that's my personal recommendation to check out his books. His most recent is 2014, and you see him on his laptop there probably writing his current book. But his most recent book, Faithless Execution, Building the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. So he does not shy away from controversy. He is perhaps best known in his private life beyond the positions I just mentioned for leading the prosecution against the blind sheikh and 11 other jihadists for their involvement in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And then he supervised the U.S. Attorney's command post near Ground Zero after 9/11. So he is deeply steeped in these issues that we're discussing today. He's always entertaining. He's always informative, often provocative. Welcome back, Andy McCarthy.
Well, thank you so much, Dean. It's a delight to be here again. I wouldn't recommend to anyone who wants to sell books in Washington or anyone else to write a book that puts impeachment and Obama in the same sentence. It's not going to be conducive to book sales, although it can be entertaining. This talk is about whether the law has become the enemy's weapon, at least where national security is concerned. It's a question that we spent a lot of time debating over the last 15 years, and it's one that I've been pondering personally for longer than that, since, as Dean mentioned, I prosecuted members of a jihadist cell after the first attack on the World Trade Center now 22 years ago. In fact, in 1999, a few months after al-Qaeda struck the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, I wrote a piece for the Weekly Standard that argued that Islamic terrorists were at war with the United States and that we needed to be on a war footing in response. That is to say, we needed to grasp the fact that the challenge facing us was a national security problem fit for military prosecution. We had been making, I think, a profound mistake by regarding it as a criminal justice problem fit almost exclusively for courtroom prosecution. 2 years later, when al-Qaeda seemingly altered the course of our history by carrying out the 9/11 atrocities that killed nearly 3,000 Americans, we were struck as a nation by the realization that what we had been doing was not working. And if you think about it, it was inevitable that our law would be exploited by our terrorist enemies. After all, our peacetime paradigm of judicial due process holds, in essence, that we would rather see the government lose. It is our proud boast that we would prefer to see any number of guilty people set free than see a single innocent person wrongly convicted. We thus presume innocence. We impose a high burden of proof on prosecutors. We require the government to satisfy other evidentiary hurdles to conduct searches and make arrests. We enforce the protective Miranda advisory regimen before a suspect who is in custody may be interrogated, and we afford publicly subsidized counsel to suspects at every stage of criminal proceedings. In peacetime, the onus is on the government, as it must be, to prove that there are convincing grounds to deprive liberty and to infringe on privacy. Terrorists, unlike conventional military forces, bank on democratic society's peacetime protocols and civil rights guarantees in order to carry out their operations. They attack civilian populations in stealth. They insinuate themselves into civilian populations and under the carapace of due process protections in order to make investigation, prosecution, or even forcible retaliation extraordinarily difficult. So, using our peacetime protocols against us is a big part of the terrorist strategy. They cannot compete with our nation in warfare as opposed to in a lawfare scenario. The laws and customs of war reverse some of our basic peacetime assumptions. Most fundamentally, in wartime, we cannot take the position that we would prefer for the government to lose, that we'd rather see our enemies go free than risk detaining the wrong person. That sounds callous to the modern ear, particularly after the way the debate has gone for the last 15 years or so, but it really is common sense. The nation should only go to war when our security or other vital interests are at stake. We cannot afford to lose in that situation, because then we risk losing the system of constitutional governance that is necessary for the protection of our liberties. That is why, for example, it has been the law of the United States since 1798 that the citizens of a nation with whom the United States is formally at war may be arrested and detained until the conclusion of hostilities. In the declared war situation, there is no burden of proving that nationals of the enemy state have taken up arms or have affirmatively aided the enemy in its war effort. The mere fact of their citizenship, the fidelity to the enemy state that it implies, is enough to justify detention. Not to mandate it, but certainly to justify it. Consider the stark contrast here. In our system of peacetime civilian due process, we don't tolerate the standard of guilt by association. But in wartime, we tolerate an even broader standard of assumed complicity with the enemy, because in wartime, our primary concern is not establishing the guilt of the accused. Instead, our primary concern is the security of the nation and the vindication of our vital interests. And that brings us to the most significant aspect of the law of war paradigm, the detention of enemy combatants. We haven't had a formally declared war in a very long time. Chances are that even if Congress were persuaded to declare war formally against a terrorist network, it would not focus on a particular sponsoring nation in a way that would trigger the Commander-in-Chief's capacity and authority to detain the citizens of that country. Plus, mass detentions would be prohibitively expensive, they'd be very hard to manage, and they'd be politically fraught in light of the shoddy way internment has been implemented at times in our history, especially, of course, during the Second World War. But we will always want to detain enemy combatants, and it will always be the right thing to do. In fact, it's not only the right thing to do. Contrary to what's been suggested over the last 15 years during our debates, it is also the humane thing to do. We often miss this rudimentary point because so much of our national security debate over the last 15 years has been dominated by the legal profession. In a law school, a courtroom, or a similar setting, when the question before the House is, does the criminal justice system work in terrorism cases, the discussion tends to revolve around due process. Can we conduct proceedings with sufficient legal protections that the guilty can be convicted and the verdict will withstand appellate scrutiny? But for most of the non-lawyer country, the question, does the criminal justice system work in terrorism cases, is a practical inquiry, not a theoretical one. It focuses on the people who most merit our concern, Americans under jihadist siege. To most of our fellow citizens, the question whether the system works is not about whether we can provide enough of a quantum of due process, it's about whether we can provide security for our nation. That is not to say that Americans are indifferent to fundamental fairness. To the contrary, if our debate has shown anything over the last 15 years, it's powerfully demonstrated that we are very concerned about ensuring that the right people are being detained, even to the point of opening the courthouse doors to our enemies, a prospect that the Supreme Court during the World War II era thought preposterous. But ordinary citizens do have their priorities in order in a way that many in our profession do not. That, I believe, is the reason we've lost sight of the humanitarian impulses behind the laws of war, including indefinite detention of enemy combatants. The detention of the enemy's operatives until the conclusion of hostilities is permitted because depleting the enemy's resources brings about a swifter end to the war and the bloodshed. The detention is only indefinite in the sense that war does not come with an end date. The laws of war are not a license to hold enemy combatants until the end of time. But they do sensibly say there is nothing humanitarian about requiring the release of fighters who will go back to the business of killing. And this is especially the case with terrorists who will go back to killing not only our civilians, but mass murdering our troops who conduct military operations honorably, that is, in accordance with the laws of war. In a terrorist war, moreover, detention is crucial because interrogation is crucial. Terrorists are never going to be defeated in traditional ways, like territorial conquest or the signing of an armistice. They can only be defeated in the sense of disrupting their operations so thoroughly that their capacity to project power is suppressed. That means our most important asset in our war now is intelligence, in the near term to prevent attacks and dismantle terror cells, and over the long haul to overwhelm the jihadist ability to function as capable aggressors. Among the very best sources of intelligence is captured terrorists. It is they who can provide precious information about ongoing plots, personnel, chain of command, and financing. Captured terrorists can be valuable informants for a very long time. And how do we know that? Well, even in ordinary law enforcement, captured members of criminal organizations who agree to become government informants have proved to be useful intelligence sources for many, many years. Agents return to them again and again for assistance in interpreting communications and in identifying previously unknown conspirators and members of criminal enterprises. Captured terrorists also fulfill that role, but more significantly, in the small window of time right after apprehension, captured terrorists can provide singular, fresh intelligence that can be exploited to prevent attacks and capture other terrorist operatives, including their commanders, before they scatter. To my mind, this remains the most essential advantage of our post-9/11 move from a strict criminal justice paradigm to a law of war paradigm. I've been a fairly vigorous participant in the debates that we've had over the Patriot Act, over surveillance authority, over military commissions. And while all of those are salient aspects of counterterrorism, the debates can wildly overstate the stakes. I was a prosecutor for almost 20 years and worked on national security cases most of the last 10, or at least a lot of the last 10. And based on that experience, I can attest that there is very little intelligence that the government can obtain by using its national security investigative powers that a resourceful prosecutor cannot obtain by using the very broad powers of ordinary law enforcement. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that we should turn national security into law enforcement. I am simply saying that if the many national security authorities that we've been arguing about for the last 15 years were repealed tomorrow, we would still have ways of acquiring most of the same intelligence. In fact, I continue to believe that the Patriot Act, for all that is written and said about it over the last 14 years, mainly enabled self-styled civil rights activists to relitigate investigative tactics that federal agents and prosecutors had been using for decades with the full knowledge and blessing of the United States courts. As far as military commissions go, they have been mostly a non-event, and sometimes they've been an outright failure. There are many reasons for this, and most of them are not the fault of the military justice system. But if the commission system shut down tomorrow, the blunt fact is that hardly anyone would notice. Yet, since we seem to be swinging back to a pre-9/11 law enforcement paradigm for national security, we must remain mindful that there are two key components of counterterrorism that cannot be replicated by the criminal justice system. The first is the capability of our military and intelligence forces to conduct operations outside the United States where terrorist organizations plot and train and organize themselves against the United States. The second is the ability to interrogate captured terrorists without counsel and without temporal limits for as long as they continue to be useful intelligence assets. I go back to the question that we started with. Has our law become our enemy's weapon against us? I used to think the simple answer was yes. But now, to refine that a bit, I don't think the law itself is the problem. It's the infusion of politics into our legal analyses. It is perfectly obvious, for example, that we need to be able to conduct military operations in order to disrupt terror networks. Osama bin Laden was under indictment by a grand jury in the Southern District of New York for almost 14 years before he was finally, as the saying goes, brought to justice. Not by a U.S. attorney, not by an FBI agent, but by the Navy SEALs. When Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was captured in Pakistan, he had been under indictment by my old office in New York for almost a decade. And Ayman al-Zawahiri, al-Qaeda's current emir, has been under indictment in the Southern District of New York for 17 years, since 1998. Judicial processes alone cannot reach the top terror tiers. Since 1993, we've only been able to prosecute a bare fraction of the jihadists who have attacked and threatened us. The percentage is never going to get much higher than that. That's simply a fact. If we are not on a semblance of war footing, both militarily and legally, we cannot contain terrorists, much less defeat them. And we have to be able to detain terrorists outside criminal justice protocols in order to maintain and build the intelligence base that enables us to protect America and American interests. Obviously, thinkers on the left and the right have a serious philosophical disagreement about whether enemy combatants who've committed provable war crimes should be subjected to military commissions or given civilian trials with all the due process that that entails. But even if the terrorists are to be given the full array of civilian judicial rights, there is no reason that has to be done immediately after capture. Captured terrorists could be designated as enemy combatants, detained indefinitely, and questioned without counsel until their usefulness has been exhausted. Then and only then should they be transferred to the civilian justice system for further proceedings. Now, at the eventual criminal trials, the civilian trials in the civilian system, obviously any statements that the captured combatants have made without the protections that our system requires cannot be used against them. And any relief they are entitled to because of a delay in bringing them into the civilian justice system can be litigated at that point. But prosecutors convict people all the time, very much including terrorists, without confessions. And microscopically few indictments are thrown out over delay in bringing suspects to court, especially when there are manifest public interest reasons for the delay. Even if we ended up losing a few cases, which is highly unlikely, national security outweighs the importance of a successful prosecution in any individual case involving any single terrorist. Keeping our intelligence database as current and detailed as it can be by promoting interrogations is clearly worth the remote risk that some terrorist at some point may evade prosecution. My fear is that we are not seeing the obvious and the legally viable because of politics. It cannot be that the highly effective aspects of law of war-based counterterrorism should be cashiered simply because they are associated with President Bush and Vice President Cheney. Those two gentlemen may be anathema to the left, but President Obama has kept their law of war paradigm in place, even as he insists that he's bringing the wars to an end. It also cannot be that because progressives regard Guantanamo Bay as a powerful symbol of American excess, we end up shutting down not only Gitmo, but the practice of detaining terrorists indefinitely so that they can be interrogated, if not at Gitmo, then someplace. It should not be that when our troops have the option on the battlefield to kill or capture, they opt to kill because the politics of what to do with those we capture are too bitter and too complicated. Our counterterrorism debates have been driven by the need to balance security with humanitarian concerns. If we've ended up in a place where killing is better than capturing, then we've made a very serious wrong turn. Let's hope that we're now up to a course correction. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'm happy to take some questions, Dean.
We've got about a half an hour for questions, so have at it, yes.
Has anybody ever asserted, or why haven't they, that terrorists, particularly illegal enemy combatants, terrorists, have no rights at all, and we should simply proceed on whatever we think is the best course of action for our national security, and that's the end of the discussion?
Do you mean no rights at all in court, or no rights at all,
no
period?
Therefore, perhaps no rights at all. They have chosen, the women put a gun to their head, they chose to be terrorists. They assume all of the disabilities, if you will, of being one, one of which is nobody's going to respect any rights that you might otherwise have under the Geneva Convention, let alone U.S. law, the U.S. Constitution.
The reason I parsed the question in the first place is because a lot of what happened, what has happened in the court system, I think happened without a lot of thought being given to it. In fact, the way that we ended up with terrorists in civilian court, certainly in the early 90s, didn't have a lot of thought attended to it. And I don't mean that, by the way, as a slap at anyone. I think what happened was, at that point in time, the only organizations domestically that trained for catastrophic events, including terrorist events, were, you know, law enforcement, first responders, and the like. So I think when the 93 bombing happened, before anybody gave it much thought, we had six people in custody. And when you have people in custody and you've only 10 days to do something about it, they were charged. And the next thing you know, the case is spun out to a judge, and then you're off to the races. And then even within the four corners of the prosecution, I don't think we ever spent a lot of time saying or challenging the view that because these people were defendants who were in court, they might not, under their peculiar circumstances, be entitled to all the rights that other people have in court. We simply gave them the full array. And that was probably right because certainly in the early cases, you had a mix of American citizens, permanent resident aliens, and some people who were illegally present in the country. And to sort out what all that might have meant in the way of what they were entitled to in the criminal justice system would have overcomplicated the case and the presentation of it to the jury. So I think a lot of what went on in the criminal justice system thoughtlessly was just the assumption that if they're here, they get everything that everybody else gets. And you know, it's been a long time, but I don't know that that view's been challenged all that much. More broadly, I don't think, to my mind, since you come at it as we have from the standpoint of the government, since we came at it kind of under the assumption, thoughtful or otherwise, that they were entitled to all of the, you know, the privileges and protections of the criminal justice system, I don't think anybody ever took the position, no, they're not entitled to anything because they don't comply with the laws and customs of war, therefore they don't even get prisoner of war protections, they get nothing. I think there's people in the room who could speak to this probably better than I can, but I think that when people in the Bush administration in particular thought about this and when we moved the paradigm over to 9/11, I think everybody came to the view, or most people came to the consensus view, that they were entitled to humane protection. They were entitled to be treated humanely, but they were not entitled to the protections that are ordinarily accorded to honorable enemy combatants. That's why it's people, I think, even strain not to call them prisoners of war, because that's a term of art that implies a whole lot of protection that they don't get. I don't think anybody ever took the position that I know of that they were entitled to nothing. And I think most of what's gone on for the ensuing 15 years has been, you know, you start here where they're in the criminal justice system and they get everything. Then you kind of move over, haphazardly is the wrong word, but without as much thought as maybe we would have liked to give it if we were acting under an emergency, to a post-9/11 paradigm where, you know, some people went to civilian court and some didn't. Some were getting military commission treatment, but the military commission rules weren't clear. Some were being detained but not getting military commission. Some of those were in the bucket of people who could be subjected to what they called enhanced interrogation tactics. Others not in that bucket. And, you know, I think we can see all that now in hindsight as it was happening at the time. I don't think there was a lot of analysis to it. Stu? It's sovereign. It's a sovereign.
It's a remarkable and elite institution. It is sort of a fighter pilot. It is the Justice Department where fighter pilots are in the universe.
Crazy people. No.
And they have enormous impact, good and I suspect for ill, on the way we handle terrorism problems. And I just wondered if you could sort of identify the best and the worst thing that the unique culture of the Southern District brought to that.
Well, there is the aspect that almost everybody who flies internationally comes into Kennedy or LaGuardia Airport, but terrorists come into tiny Westchester County Airport, which happens to be in the Southern District of New York rather than the Eastern District of New York. So that was certainly, you know, one aspect of it. I think to the extent that mistakes were made in our approach, I think they were not mistakes born of the culture of the Southern District. I think they were mistakes born of the fact that we took something that, if we had looked at it more carefully, was clearly a national security problem, and we turned it into mainly a criminal justice problem, with the upshot of that being that everything was done to serve the litigation and the prosecutions, which was not the best approach globally as far as the country was concerned, as far as national security was concerned, to the broader terrorism problem. And I wrote a memoir about the investigation years ago, and I talk in the book about the CIA and how I had to go to the CIA because some of our defendants were raising what the United States did in Afghanistan. They wanted to make that part of their defense at trial. The theory being, I couldn't have been at war with the United States. We had charged them with seditious conspiracy, which is levying war against the US. They wanted to make a defense that I wasn't at war with the United States. I was shoulder to shoulder with the CIA in Afghanistan fighting the Red Menace, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I remember going to the CIA, and it was a bracing experience because up until that point, and you never think of New York as insular, right? But I was treated like royalty.
You're in New York.
Yeah. But I mean, I was treated like a star, right? Because I'm like the big prosecutor who's running the big case, and you know, I get down to the CIA, and they're like, "Who are you? Why do we need to tell you anything? And you're just a lawyer, and maybe you're wearing a white hat today, but by next week you'll be someplace else, and everything we tell you'll be, you know, in that whole community." And I mean, I was much younger. I was not nearly as read up on things as I am now. And I sort of had a sense of entitlement when I went there that I was obviously, because my case was the most important thing happening in the United States, and certainly the White House was treating it that way, that I expected cooperation. And if I needed to know what we were doing in Afghanistan, then I wanted to know what we were doing in Afghanistan. And these guys came from a culture like, we don't care about your stupid case. We care about protecting the American people. And so I had a conversation with one guy, like, we now know that Pakistan was our cutout in Afghanistan. I say we now know. When I was there in 1993, we knew then, too. There had been books written about it. There had been, you know, stuff had been in the general press for years and years. So I wanted them to simply tell me that it was Pakistan. They wouldn't do it. I mean, they ultimately did it because in the litigation they had to, but I had to fight them to get something that everybody knew. And it was because in the culture they're in, which is about protecting lives, not winning cases, when they give a commitment about maintaining the security of information, they never violate it. Even if everybody in the world knows the quote-unquote secret, they don't give it up. And I was used to being able to go across the street to the FBI and say to an agent who didn't want to tell me anything, hey, look, Bozo, you want to be on the stand and have the judge asking you the questions, or you're going to tell me? And trying to handle it that way. And there was no going into that mode with these guys. So I think to the extent mistakes were made by this process, I'm not sure it was unique to the Southern District of New York, except to the extent that we are more arrogant than other places. But we did lean on them to change in ways that may not have been helpful. And, you know better than I do, we did tie ourselves in knots regulation-wise in terms of one side of the house being able to cooperate with the other side of the house in ways that they thought were, frankly, insane, and had to at least suggest to them that cooperating with us, meaning the law enforcement side, was not in the best interest of the country. On. I've heard of him. I think a great deal, and I have heard that it's been paralyzing for them, and I can't see how it wouldn't be. And this goes back to what I was just mentioning to Stuart a second ago. You know, the internal regulations that we made that became known infamously as the wall, right, back in the 90s. When you looked at the wall regulations carefully, you know, there was always, somebody was always able to say, well, but if you look at, paragraph 17, sub C, II, it looks like this is the kind of communication that actually could have been thrown over the wall. So I always thought for the people who wanted to shut down cooperation between the two sides, the wall regs were the best of all worlds. They had a defense in them if something catastrophic happened where some bureaucrat could say, oh, no. That you could easily have communicated that if you just, read the regulations more carefully. But in the meantime, the ethos that they created in the government, which is far more important than what the rules actually said, communicated to the agents that if you want to stay out of trouble, the best thing to do is don't cooperate. And don't go the extra mile, don't take the extra step, don't challenge the authorities that don't want the cooperation for whatever reason. So I think a lot of times with things like those regulations and with what happened to the CIA agents, it's not so much the details of the particular rule or the particular prosecution. It's the signal that it sends to everybody else in the organization about how we want to conduct ourselves and how we want to be understood. And I think what happened with the CIA investigation, apart from the fact that it really was shameful to reinvestigate it when it had been vetted not by political types but by actual career prosecutors, and it had been done under circumstances where I certainly believe that if there had been a prosecutable case or prosecutable cases, they would have been brought, given all of the criticism that the government had come under. So there was a good reason to believe that set of conduct had been scrutinized carefully enough, and if professional investigators and prosecutors decided there wasn't a case there, to leave it alone. By reopening it and saying, you know, we're going to redouble the effort and we want to get these guys, it told everybody else in the intelligence community, you know, look, if you want to take a step in a gray area, whether it's enhanced interrogation or any of the many other gray areas that exist in intelligence, you better understand that even if you think you have a license from the Justice Department today, today's Justice Department is not going to be the Justice Department forever. And when administrations change and when new people come in, especially if they're the people who've been representing the people that we've been trying to detain and prosecute, et cetera, there could be a whole new ballgame. And you could not only be looking at being reprimanded and all the professional downsides that entails, you could be looking at being prosecuted. And when you communicate that message to people who are on the wall being asked to do extraordinary things to protect the country, you're inviting those things not to be done. And unfortunately, I think that's what's happened a lot with the intelligence community. Yes, sir.
So that sounds like an internal impediment to our achieving. What about jurisdiction issues, since cybersecurity is like shattered glass, the enemy's everywhere and hiding everywhere, where the servers are? How are foreign governments cooperating or not cooperating? I think a lot of people say, well, that's not here, that enemy's not there, and it's not formally states that are doing something. So how do you work with that problem?
Yeah, I don't think there's one answer to that. My sense is, and I've been out of it for a long time on the day-to-day level of it, but my sense is that there are levels of cooperation which are almost as various as the numbers of countries and intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies involved. I think we even have sometimes significant differences in cooperation between the intelligence community of a country versus their law enforcement people. You know, just because you get one level with one doesn't mean you'll get it with the other. So I think it's a lot of it is a lot of it's hit and miss, and to the extent that you could make any bright line rule as far as encouraging or discouraging cooperation is concerned, I think if we get a reputation for disclosing stuff that shouldn't be disclosed, particularly if we're disclosing it to make political points, or if we get a reputation for doing things that are, that score political points in the short term, but from a national security perspective are dumb things to do. Like, for example, I don't want to get hyper-political here, but you know, when you get bin Laden and you get into his hideout and you take away tons of stuff, you don't need to tell, you don't need to find the nearest microphone and say, and by the way, you know, we got reams and reams of stuff that we took out of his compound. And, you know, look, didn't we just, the president just announced, it was about a week ago, that there had been this operation in which the two hostages were killed, right? It turned out that was in January. You know, he for whatever reason, they picked last week to make the announcement, and maybe it was because the press had it and they were going to jump the gun or whatever. But the point is, you don't always have to act immediately, and you don't always have to run to the nearest microphone immediately. And when you're dealing with an outfit like Al-Qaeda that basically trains people to say, you know, look, we're asking you to hold out for 3 to 6 days. And after that, you not only don't have to hold out, tell them everything. Because by then we can, you know, do all the things we need to do to scatter and cover tracks and everything else. And you'll confuse them by doing it that way. If we know from dealing with them all these years that they have these practices and that they anticipate, you know, arrest and they have procedures in place for what happens if somebody gets captured, you know, why tell them anything that we don't have to tell them? And I think other intelligence, it's not like the other countries that we deal with don't have these same, you know, political pressures and cultivating their medias and all that stuff to think about. But I think, to my mind, we're convincing other countries that we're not serious and that we're sloppy and sometimes we're reckless. And when you do that, you can't expect to get the same level of cooperation. And I'm not in a position anymore to gauge whether that theory is actually accurate on the ground, but I bet it is.
Are there similar legacies to prosecutions of terrorists since 9/11? Are there laws that you would sunset? Are there things that you think need to be done? Is there any kind of wrong word, but you know what I mean? Is there some kind of remnant that exists in
prosecutions? Yeah, that's a great point, because I think people who make policy want most of the cases in the criminal justice system. And as a result, at least for public consumption, and maybe even for a lot of private or elite consumption, the errors that happen in the criminal justice system, we rationalize. Whereas when the problem comes up in the military commission, there's a lot of people who are saying, see, we should never have done that in the first place. So they have a higher burden than we do in the criminal justice system in a lot of ways, just because of perception, or at least that perception. And for example, we had a case, was it 3 years ago, where a guy was convicted, I think this was the embassy bombing guy, was acquitted on 284 of 285 counts. Now, happened for him, while his lawyer was out there saying, I beat the government in 284 counts, he's doing life, because the one count he was convicted on was a life count. So, you know, there, a lot of people who are apologists for the justice system and doing most of the cases there said, the system works. And I look at that case and I say, man, you know, 283. Yeah, right, exactly. How close did we come? So, you know, I think we tend to rationalize a lot of what goes wrong in the justice system. And we also have set up in the justice system what I regard to be a false test of success. People who want the cases in the criminal justice system have said from the beginning, we're batting 1,000. You know, everybody who gets brought in up until very recently not only always got convicted, but got convicted on virtually every single count. And the problem with that way of looking at it is there has never been a question whether we had the ability to do a proceeding that was fair and could get people convicted at the end and that the appellate courts would look at and think were marvelous prosecutions and that everybody had done a great job. The question is whether doing these cases in the civilian justice system and making our due process protocols apply to a national security situation forces us to give up so much in the way of intelligence, et cetera, that we are endangering the country even if we can get people convicted. So, you know, I think the civilian justice system has tended to both poo-poo a lot of the things that have gone wrong and make sure that it's judged by a standard that's not really a national security standard, but more of a, you know, can we get convictions standard. So it's very forgiving. As far as like the legacy of it, you know, it's a very different world. It was a very different world even from the time we prosecuted the World Trade Center guys in 93 to 1996 when counterterrorism law gets totally overhauled. I've always thought, you know, for all of the back and forth we've had over the Patriot Act, the most important legislative development in counterterrorism in the last quarter century is the 1996 overhaul of terrorism law. Because the Patriot Act, again, for all the back and forth over it, really has mainly the effect of enabling national security investigators to have the same tools that the criminal justice guys have been using for 30 or 40 years. Whereas the 1996 Act took a situation where I had to charge the blind sheikh and his guys with seditious conspiracy, which is a Civil War era statute, because we didn't have a terrorism statute that fit what they did. I mean, back in 1993, if you conducted a successful bombing from the terrorist standpoint and actually killed people, we had a bombing statute. It worked fine. If you just conspired to conduct a bombing, even if you were conspiring to kill 10, 20,000 people, we had no bombing conspiracy statute. You had to bring that under what we called, you know, the catch-all federal conspiracy statute, which has a penalty of 0 to 5 years. So a lot of, back when I had hair, a lot of the pulling out of hair was caused by trying to figure out what the hell to charge the blind sheikh people with, because it was almost like you were being penalized for the success of thwarting their attempt. After 1996, you can have a robust philosophical argument about whether this is a war problem that belongs in a military justice system or a crime problem that belongs in the civilian system, but you could never again argue that prosecutors and investigators didn't have tools in the criminal justice system that were adequate to, or at least commensurate with the behavior that we were dealing with. I think in the military system, they're still wrestling with what a war crime is. And a lot of that, I think, is because they've constructed the military system kind of on the fly, and they've had to do it, again, swatting at people who wanted the military system for this particular conflict to be a nullity, you know, to basically be nullified in its ability to conduct proceedings. That hasn't happened in the civilian system. The civilian systems have had every advantage, and they've had everybody putting their thumb on the scale to try to get it to work as opposed to not work. So, you know, maybe the legacy is different from what it ought to be, but I think it continues to be the case, and it's especially the case now with this administration, that they want the criminal justice system to work, they want to show that it works, and it's going to get every bounce of the ball to get it to work. Well, the first thing we have to do is be able to speak honestly about what the threat is. The worst thing of all the bad things that have happened, and this is not just an Obama problem, I think Obama, you know, exacerbated it to a fare-thee-well, but this actually goes back to parts of the Bush administration where we began to take the position. And this is actually, if you've ever talked to terrorists, this is like crazy stuff. We took the position that they somehow judge themselves on the basis of how we speak about them. And it affects their self-esteem and their ability to influence other people in the Muslim community, how the United States addresses them. So let's not say jihadist, let's not say mujahideen, let's not say Islamo-fascist. Let's not acknowledge what I had to prove in court 22 years ago, which is that there was a nexus between forcible commands in Islamic scripture through the mediating force of somebody influential like the blind sheikh. You know, we put out that the blind sheikh was a complete nutcase, right? That's what the image that they wanted people to believe. He's a doctor of Islamic jurisprudence, graduated from Al-Azhar University, which is the seat of Sunni Islamic learning since the 9th or 10th century. If you think about it, he's incapable of doing a single thing that would be helpful to a terrorist organization. He can't build a bomb, he can't conduct an attack, he's got every malady known to man. What's the one thing he can do? He can run it. And why? Why has he got that capability? Because he is a master of the doctrine. That's the source of the reverence for him, and that's the source of his influence over not only the terror network that we had in New York, globally, the guy is a renowned expert in Sharia law. It should have occurred to us, I think, a long time ago that that's a matter of some importance, and that you can't investigate or hope to thwart the people that you need to stop without being able to understand what it is they believe, why they believe it, and what they're trying to accomplish. And we put that in a black box, and we say we're not going to look at that. It can't be that you can have a sensible national security strategy without taking notice of what the enemy's threat doctrine is. And, you know, one of the terrible things we do as a government is we have listened to and empowered all the wrong Muslims. My experience as a prosecutor having to investigate these cases and try to get cooperation, and I should point out that the first Muslims I met in the case I worked on were Muslims who were going into terrorist organizations pretending to be terrorists to help us stop terrorist threats, and Muslims who were helping us translate Arabic conversations so we could whip it into a compelling narrative and put it in front of the jury. So I've seen both sides of this from the beginning. And what we noticed, at least back in the early 90s, I don't know what their theory about it is these days, was that rank and file people in the Muslim community were pretty cooperative with us. They were adamant that they didn't want their cooperation to be known, and that was frustrating, although not hard to understand. But they were supportive of the idea of that you had to indict and prosecute mass murderers. They were fine with that. Where we had a problem was with the leadership of the mosques and especially the Islamic community centers and the well-known Islamist organizations that are either subsets of the Muslim Brotherhood or have extensive interconnection with the Muslim Brotherhood. Those outfits tended to be very the opposite of supportive of what they were doing, even though they would sometimes put on the public face of support. And I think because we got into this in the early 90s and we didn't have an intelligence base like we had with organized crime, which, by the way, you know, back in the 1950s, they didn't have a great intelligence base in organized crime either. But, you know, all of a sudden we're having mass murder attacks and we don't have good intel, not only in the Muslim communities domestically, but outside the United States as well. And people thought that the best shortcut to overcoming that problem was to deal with the leadership of the Islamist organizations. And I think that was, it's been a terrible experience, because what all we've managed to do is empower people who don't have America's first interests at stake. So the first thing I would do is let it be known that we are now speaking freely about this, and we're going to just trust that most Muslims in America don't have such tender sensibilities that, you know, that they can't understand that what we're trying to do is direct our efforts at the people who are anti-American and trying to conduct violent attacks, and that for the most part, we embrace the Muslim community in the United States and we want its cooperation. And I know that we've treated that for 20 years like it's an impossibility. To me, it's like, I just don't understand it. It seems pretty elementary. So that I would do first and foremost. I still like the idea of a national security court. I heard John and Stuart and some of the other folks on the other panel before talking about, you know, how we have these two paradigms, and we kind of that's what we've got. It's like, you know, those are the two sort of sets of tools that we have to attack any problem, and it either fits into this one or it fits into this one. And so we've tried to do the criminal justice system with jihadist terror, and we find that it really doesn't resemble a crime wave in any way that makes it a sensible fit. But at the same time, you know, the laws of war are not a perfect fit for this by any stretch. I mean, think about it. If you were just going by the logic of the laws of war, the fact that terrorists don't wear uniforms, insinuate themselves in civilian populations, endanger civilian populations even when they're just trying to protect themselves as opposed to conducting attacks, all the things they do that are deemed to be savage under the laws of war, you would think we would say, because they take that position, we should give them less in the way of due process, because they're undermining every humanitarian foundation of the laws of war. And instead, we as a country, and I think this is admirable about the United States, we want to make sure we're not holding the wrong people. And unless you catch somebody absolutely in the act or have unbelievably transparent, great intelligence on them, there's often going to be ambiguity when terrorists are detained, because they don't present like, you know, Nazi soldiers. They simply don't. And as a result, we feel like we need to give a quantum of due process to make sure that we're not holding the wrong people. So I think that ought to be some indication to us that the laws of war are not a perfect fit for this either. And what I would like to see happen is that we have a system where you have regular Article 3 federal judges presiding over the proceedings for two reasons. One, because of expertise, that it's clear that they've built up a track record of doing these cases, and they've done overall a phenomenal job on them. But secondly, even if they hadn't done as good a job, whether you and I think military commissions are fine or not, our allies don't. And a lot of what they say about them isn't true. You know, they say the executive branch is the judge, jury, and executioner and all that stuff. In many ways, it doesn't matter whether they're saying is true or not, and whether we think that military commissions are constitutionally viable. The fact is, they say what they say, they think what they think, and they won't cooperate as much as they should with the military system. And I think having civilian judges play a role over it would address the concern about it being a unilateral executive branch show. It would give it a measure of independence that would give them a comfort level to cooperate with it more. And then I would want to have mainly a law of war paradigm. You need to be able to detain people and hold them, and you really need to be able to protect classified information. There's no way to script what your disclosure obligations are in a civilian trial, even in pretrial discovery, much less what erps out during the trial. So I'd want to see a kind of an amalgam of the two systems that's tailored toward the threat that we actually have. And I, you know, to go back to what I said in my remarks, there's a lot of political freight on both sides of this. I think if there hadn't been so much, we probably would have done something like this already. But we really need to tailor a response that both works precisely with the threat that we now understand a lot better than we did in 1993, and encourages our allies to cooperate with it. Because if you don't have a system they'll cooperate with, then you're just outsourcing your counterterrorism to people who have a lot less interest in it than you do. So you asked me for three, and I went on like a windbag, but I only gave you two. Sorry. When have you heard? Thank you. Thank you, Andy. Is there a next Andy McCarthy book that you can tell us about? And
not unless someone waterboards me.
Okay, well, thank you all so much for coming here today. We certainly appreciate it. I think it's been a great conference. It's recorded, so we will send around a link to the recordings, and you can forward that to your friends and colleagues. And again, thanks.